Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, October 19th on Iris. I'm your reader, Dagna, and I'll be reading local and state news. We will begin with today's mini editorial, which is written by the Journal Editorial Board. And they write, "We've been treated to beautiful warm weather the last few days. We hope you were able to get out and enjoy it, with cooler, more typical mid-October days ahead this week." Again, this was written by the Journal Editorial Board. Our top story today is headlined, 185th Receives Mobilization Orders to Help Afghan Refugees Settle in U.S. And this was written by Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal. About 30 members of the 185th Air Refueling Wing in Sioux City will be deployed to help resettle Afghan refugees. A total of 65 Iowa National Guard members, including members of the 185th and the 132nd Wing in Des Moines, will be assigned to an undisclosed location in the United States to assist with Operation Allies Welcome, an ongoing effort to bring U.S. citizens home from Afghanistan and to resettle vulnerable Afghan refugees, according to a press release from the Iowa National Guard. The Guard members will deploy for approximately 60 to 90 days under Title 10 federal deployment orders starting in November. They will be providing logistical, sustainment, and interagency support for Afghan refugees in the United States, according to the Iowa National Guard. Captain Kevin Waldron, Deputy Public Affairs Officer with the Iowa National Guard, said Monday he could not immediately provide details about where in the U.S. the 185th Airmen are going. "It could be a variety of locations," Waldron said. "They do fall under U.S. Northern Command, so that command encompasses the greater 50 states and the U.S. territories, so within that region." Tens of thousands of Afghan refugees evacuated from Kabul after the Taliban took control of the country arrived in the United States in recent months, largely without a clear roadmap to resettlement. Many evacuees are temporarily living at U.S. military bases. U.S. forces departed Afghanistan late this summer on the order of President Joe Biden, who vowed to end the 20-year military engagement there. U.S. troops arrived in 2001 and quickly toppled the Taliban, which had provided sanctuary for al-Qaeda, perpetrators of the September 11th attacks. The Taliban rapidly took control of the country as U.S. forces were leaving, bringing with them the threat of harsh reprisals against Afghans who had allied themselves with U.S. fighting forces. The Biden administration faced a torrent of criticism for a faulty and slow evacuation plan that criticisms claimed left many U.S. citizens and Afghan allies behind. Since August 14th, nearly 130,000 people, including about 5,000 Americans, were airlifted out of Afghanistan. At least 53,000 Afghans who left on those flights have been housed at U.S. bases, according to federal officials. Our next headline is, "Black Raspberry Wine and Czech Amber Lager Win Top Honors at Schleswig Contest." Ida Grove. Dwayne Olson of Glenwood was awarded Grand Champion Beer Honors, and Don Preby of Mason City was named the Grand Champion Winemaker during the Schleswig Wine and Beer Club's 46th annual contest held Saturday in Ida Grove. Olson won the competition with a Czech Amber Lager and Preby with a Black Raspberry Wine. A Black Raspberry Wine by Preby was also named the Grand Champion winner at the 2020 contest. The Reserve Champion Wine was a dry cherry wine vinted by Lester Zonley of Correctionville, and the Reserve Champion Beer was awarded to a maple bourbon stout brewed by Jason Wolf of Oldebolt. The winners each received a traveling trophy. In addition to brewing the Grand Champion Beer, Olson won third-place beer honors with the German Peels. Jeff Holmes of Battle Creek was a third-place wine winner with his Marquette wine, and J. Randall of Dunlap won honorable mention with a peach Chardonnay. The head wine judge was Dennis Crabb of Denison, and the head beer judge was Jeff Postel of Ankeny. There were 42 beers entered in the contest, with 8 advancing to the championship round. There were 35 entries in the wine competition. Our next story is headlined, "Sioux City Council Votes to Change Snow Ordinance." And this was written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. The Sioux City Council unanimously voted Monday in favor of amending the city snow ordinance, which will only make parking on emergency snow routes illegal when the mayor has declared a snow emergency. City code currently states that it is illegal to park on an emergency snow route, either when the mayor declares a snow emergency and when there is 2 inches of snowfall. Though this entire chapter of the code says that it would only applies during snow emergencies, the amendment eliminates the 2-inch condition. Public Works Director Dave Carney said most of the emergency snow routes are downtown. And then we add a line, because it becomes a little bit of an issue with downtown when the streets are cleared but the snow emergency has not been lifted. Where can I or can't I park down there, Carney said. So it adds language saying that when the windrows are removed and the parking is clear, even if there is still a snow emergency, you'll be able to park on the snow routes. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore asked Carney how visitors to the city, as well as residents, will know when the mayor has declared a snow emergency. Carney told Moore a message will be posted on the marquees at both the Tyson Events Center and the Orpheum Theater. These are primarily small businesses that we're talking about, and it could really hurt them if no one really understands where we can park, Moore said. Reagan Cote, executive director of Downtown Partners, told the council the changes make the ordinance much clearer for downtown small business owners. They weren't clear on when 2 inches really applied and how they're supposed to know, so it just makes it a little easier for us, too, to promote it, she said. Councilman Alex Waters encouraged residents to sign up for Code Red, an emergency management platform that delivers alerts related to snow emergencies and other urgent matters via phone call, text message, email, and social media posts. It is a great service that we allow. It lets you know right away, and then you know where you need to park and what you need to do. Residents can register by visiting bit.ly/3TTEK77 or enrolling via cell phone by texting Alert Sioux City to 99411. Maverick shooting suspect faces federal charge. A Sioux City man accused of shooting a woman outside a Sioux City gentleman's club now faces federal prosecution. A complaint filed in U.S. District Court in Sioux City charges Rudy Johnson, 27, with one count of being a felon in the possession of ammunition. He also faces possible revocation of his supervised release from a previous federal conviction for a 2012 armed robbery. A federal grand jury has yet to return an indictment in his case. Johnson is accused of shooting Krista Krukenberg, 28, of Sioux Falls outside Mavericks Gentlemen's Club at 416 Cunningham Drive on December 20th. According to court documents, Krukenberg and her friends began arguing with another woman and her friends, and they went outside to fight. During the fight between Krukenberg's friend and a woman who was Johnson's girlfriend, Johnson fired 8 shots into the group of people watching. Krukenberg was struck 6 or 7 times, including in her jaw, shoulder, pelvis, foot, and both arms. Johnson then grabbed his girlfriend and they fled. Johnson was arrested July 16th in Indiana. He was charged in Woodbury County District Court with a willful injury, going armed with intent, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, assault while participating in a felony, reckless use of a firearm, and felon in possession of a firearm, and was to stand trial October 26. Woodbury County Attorney Patrick Jennings filed for a dismissal of the case last week after the federal complaint was filed. District Judge Roger Saylor dismissed the case Friday. Johnson was sentenced in 2013 to more than 16 years in federal prison, but a portion of that sentence was vacated in accordance with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the wording in one of the charges of which he and his co-defendants was convicted was unconstitutional. In December, a federal judge resentenced Johnson to time served and placed him on 3 years supervised release. Johnson was subsequently released from federal prison. Sioux City man found guilty of attempted murder. Onawa. A Sioux City man who ran over a man on a motorcycle on Interstate 29 and stole 2 pickup trucks has been found guilty of attempted murder and other charges. A jury in Monona County District Court returned its verdict Friday evening, finding Jamie Powell guilty of 2 counts of each of attempted murder intimidation with a dangerous weapon, and operating a motor vehicle without owner's consent, and one count of felon in possession of a firearm. District Judge Roger Saylor scheduled sentencing for December 3rd. Powell, 40, faces 25-year prison sentences for attempted murder, 10-year prison sentences for intimidation with a dangerous weapon, and 5-year prison sentences for each of the remaining charges. At sentencing, Saylor will determine if the sentences will be served consecutively, one after the other, or concurrently, at the same time, or some combination of the two. Powell was arrested December 27th after he fired shots at a woman in her vehicle and then ran over Richard Polak, who was driving a motorcycle on southbound Interstate 29 near Whiting. Powell's pickup left the road and was immobilized after coming to rest on top of the motorcycle. He left the scene and stole a pickup from a nearby farm and crashed through a livestock fence and into a tree before abandoning it. He stole a second pickup from another residence and was later found driving it in Sioux City and arrested. Polak of Sioux City was hospitalized in Sioux City after the incident. Powell and Polak had been in a fight earlier in Sioux City. Investigators found 2 bullet holes in the vehicle driven by the woman who had reported the shooting on the interstate. And then our next headline is, Sioux City man pleads not guilty in California murder case. Fresno, California. A Sioux City man charged with a California homicide is scheduled to stand trial in January. Isaac Helms, 20, pleaded not guilty Thursday to charges of murder, second-degree robbery, and receiving stolen property. His trial was scheduled for January 13th in Fresno County Superior Court. Precious Green, 21, of Sioux City, also is charged with murder and second-degree robbery. Her arraignment is scheduled for November 4th. Both are charged with the September 26, 2019 robbery setup that resulted in the fatal shooting of a Fresno man. A third Sioux Citian, Hannah Hayward, 21, pleaded guilty in November to second-degree robbery in exchange for the dismissal of a murder charge. Alexa Ramos, 22, of Fireball, California, also has pleaded guilty to second-degree robbery and will have a murder charge dismissed. Neither Hayward nor Ramos have been sentenced. Authorities believe Helms, Green, Hayward, and Ramos set up a meeting with Tyrell Truss, 20, in order to rob him. According to the Fresno County Sheriff's Office, while the five were riding in a car, an altercation took place and Helms shot Truss. Helms, Green, Hayward, and Ramos then attempted to flee but were detained by officers dispatched to the scene. Detectives found a gun believed to have been used in the shooting, and Helms, Green, Hayward, and Ramos were found in possession of Truss' items. Driver dies in crash Monday morning. A person died as a result of a single vehicle accident that occurred Monday morning on the 2800 block of 18th Street. At around 8 a.m., Sioux City Police responded to the accident. Upon arrival, officers found that a commercial vehicle had veered off the roadway and into a grouping of trees. The driver was pronounced dead at the scene. An eyewitness reported the vehicle was traveling westbound when it crossed into the oncoming lane and ultimately left the roadway. It doesn't appear as if the driver made any attempt to stop the vehicle or correctively steer back onto the road. The cause of the accident remains under investigation, but officers say it was potentially related to a medical issue. The driver's name is not being released pending notification of next of kin. National Drug Take-Back Day nears. The Sioux City Police Department will be participating in the DEA National Drug Take-Back Program at 5 locations in Sioux City from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday. The locations are at Drilling Pharmacy at 4010 Morningside Avenue, Fairway at 4040 War Eagle Drive, Walgreens at 101 Pierce Street, Hy-Vee at 2827 Hamilton Boulevard, and the Hy-Vee at 3301 Gordon Drive. This biannual event is an opportunity for people to safely dispose of unused prescription medication at one of the collection sites that will be manned by Sioux City police officers. This is anonymous and no record of who drops off medication will be kept. During the last national drug take-back, the Sioux City Police Department collected more than 260 pounds of medication for disposal. I-29 ramp to close for bridge project. An Interstate 29 ramp in Sioux City will be temporarily closed on Thursday and Friday in connection with a bridge deck overlay project on U.S. Highway 20. The ramp from southbound I-29 to westbound U.S. 20 is scheduled to be closed from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. both days, weather permitting, the Iowa Department of Transportation said. While the ramp is closed, traffic will be deterred to Singing Hills Boulevard, then to northbound I-29 and to westbound U.S. 20. Sioux City man gets 25 years for shooting. A Sioux City man was sentenced Monday to 25 years in prison for a shooting near downtown Sioux City. Tyrone Mallory, 20, pleaded guilty in writing Thursday in Woodbury County District Court to willful injury, going armed with intent, and reckless use of a firearm. A charge of attempted murder was dismissed as part of the plea agreement. District Judge Roger Saylor entered the sentencing order Monday morning. Mallory must serve a minimum of 5 years before he's eligible for parole. Mallory shot the victim July 28th in an alley behind 1411 Pierce Street. Police obtained video showing Mallory shooting the 33-year-old victim in the lower back, buttocks, and the back of the knee. Mallory was arrested 2 days later. The victim was hospitalized at Mercy One Soulan Medical Center for treatment of his wounds. We'll now have a brief recap of the upcoming weather. And so today is supposed to be sunny and breezy in the afternoon with a predicted high of 76. And tonight has a low of 48. Wednesday, it should be cooler with a few afternoon showers with a high of 57 and a low of 38. Thursday will be partial sunshine with a high of 54 and a low of 33. Friday is also partial sunshine with a high of 56 and a low of 27. And Saturday will have intervals of sun and clouds, high of 55 and a low of 36. And the sunrise, today it was at 7:43 a.m. and it will set at 6:37. And tomorrow the sun will rise at 7:44 and set at 6:35. Hy-Vee prepares for vax mandate. Grocer asks its 91,000 employees to show cards. Communications circulated among Hy-Vee employees statewide last week regarding the company's reaction to President Joe Biden's emergency order requiring federal employees to be vaccinated and set social media rumbling. Many who posted and commented appeared to believe that a video posted on the Hy-Vee staff website and a letter circulated to Hy-Vee site managers were ordering employees to provide proof of vaccination by October 22nd or face weekly testing at their own expense. What's really happening, according to Tina Potthoff, Hy-Vee Senior Vice President of Communication, is that the company is preparing for a possible federal rule requiring all employers with at least 100 employees show proof of their staffs being vaccinated or are being tested weekly for COVID-19. Companies that fail to comply could face up to $14,000 in fines per violation. The rule, which the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, is developing, is expected in the next couple of months. But little is known beyond that, leaving companies to figure out how best to prepare. Hy-Vee is asking its 91,000 employees to provide the company a copy of their vaccination card by Friday so they can get a better handle on how many tests it may need to have on hand on a weekly basis to meet the federal rules requirement. Hy-Vee is not mandating its employees get vaccinated, Potthoff said via email. At this time, we're trying to be prepared should this go into effect by the federal government. Hy-Vee is not the only Iowa company preparing for the rule, first unveiled by President Joe Biden on September 9th, when he also issued an executive order requiring all federal employees and contractors to be vaccinated. Potthoff said her company has seen copies of communications from several other Iowa businesses preparing for the rule to be implemented. Several Iowa employers have gone a step further and enacted vaccine mandates, including Mercy One, Tyson, and Meredith Corporation. The October 15 deadline was set for accounting purposes and not to force action, Potthoff said. If a Hy-Vee employee is not vaccinated or does not want to share their vaccination status with the company, their job will not be in jeopardy. And if an employee needs to be tested weekly, should the rule take effect, that will not come at the employee's expense, but Hy-Vee's, Potthoff added. But that also means the company, which says it's the state's largest employer, needs to have some solid numbers to go by. Until then, and if the rule does not go into effect, Hy-Vee's COVID-19 policy remains status quo. We ask that employees who are not vaccinated wear a mask to work, But we have never mandated a vaccine and are not mandating one now, Potthoff said. The company is offering any employee who gets vaccinated a $100 gift card. About 50% of Iowans are fully vaccinated. There are more than 2,200 companies in the state that have more than 100 employees. Iowa officials strike hopeful tone on John Deere strike. Iowa's elected leaders mostly struck hopeful tones while not favoring either John Deere or its striking workers when commenting on the ongoing labor dispute Monday. The lone exception may be Democratic U.S. Representative Sidney Axne, who expressed her support for the workers and labor union and greeted striking workers on the picket line Monday in Ankeny. Monday marked the fifth day of the impasse between Deere & Company and Automobile, Aerospace, and Agriculture Implement Workers of America, or the UAW. The two sides returned to the negotiating table Monday, a union spokesman and company official said. The strike affects about 10,000 workers at factories in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas. I am confident that both parties will work together through the process and come to a successful resolution that benefits both the employees and the employer, Governor Kim Reynolds said via her spokesman on Monday. Workers say that agriculture manufacturer isn't offering adequate wage and benefit increases as the company enjoys record profits. Union members say they experience mandatory overtime, an increasing workload, and lack of support from managers. In its latest offer, Deere bargained for incremental wage increases over 6 years, equal to about 5 to 6% raise in hourly pay at the end of the 6-year contract. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley is a former factory worker and union member at a furnace register company in Waterloo. He, too, expressed hope that a deal will be reached swiftly and that the negotiations do not become too politicized. I know what it's like to go on strike as a member of the International Machinists when I worked at Waterloo Register, Grassley said Monday via spokesman. I hope this doesn't become too politicized. The rights of the workers are protected by law, and I expect good faith bargaining by both parties. I hope all involved are able to come to a swift resolution. In a Friday social media post, Grassley added some empathy for the striking workers and their families. The Deere workers and their families now face a stressful situation, Grassley posted. I hope good faith bargaining can bring the dispute to a swift conclusion for the good of all parties and our Iowa economy. The Bureau sought comment on the strike from Reynolds, the state's entire congressional delegation, and the Iowa Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau did not respond, nor did the office of U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, whose eastern Iowa district includes the Deere factory in Waterloo. A spokeswoman on Friday told the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier that Hinson does not have an official comment and that she is monitoring the situation closely. A spokesman for the U.S. Senator Joni Ernst on Monday also said that Ernst is monitoring the latest on the situation. Axne spoke with striking workers on the picket line at the Deere factory in Ankeny on Monday. A spokesman for her office pointed to Axne's social media post about the strike. Our workers are the backbone of our economy, and they deserve the pay and benefits that provide them a middle-class life and retirement, Axne posted on Friday. That's why I stand in solidarity with the hard-working members of the union as they begin their strike for a fair contract. A spokeswoman for U.S. Representative Marinette Miller Meeks, whose eastern Iowa district includes the homes of many who work in a Quad Cities area Deere factory, pointed to the Congresswoman's social media post on the strike. John Deere has employed thousands of Iowa families for decades and has been a boost to the Iowa economy. I hope business and labor can rapidly find common ground that benefits each other, and we can continue being a shining example of what a hard day's work means, Miller Meeks posted. U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, who represents Iowa's 4th Congressional District, struck a similarly hopeful and balanced tone. John Deere, the manufacturing industry, and the men and women who build essential equipment are critical to the success of Iowa's economy, he said via his office spokesman. I am hopeful that business leaders and workers are able to reach an agreement to resolve this dispute. And then we have another article about the John Deere strike. And the headline for that one is, Farmer Suppliers Worry About John Deere Strike. Farmers and Deere and Company suppliers are worried about what the strike at the tractor makers' factories will mean for their livelihoods. More than 10,000 Deere employees went on strike last week at 14 Deere factories in Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Colorado, and Georgia after the United Auto Workers Union rejected a contract offer. The longer the strike continues, the greater the impact will be on the communities around the plants. If this gets sorted out in a couple of days, great, said Brian Jones, who farms in central Iowa. But if it drags out for weeks, you start getting a little concerned about things. Lance Lillybridge, who farms in eastern Iowa near Cedar Rapids, said he worries about not having parts should his John Deere combine break down. We have a lot of big equipment out there that we're using to bring in a harvest, and if a part breaks down that we can't get, then we're done, said Lillybridge, who is president of the Iowa Corn Growers Association Board. Burke Skeet Mia of American Pattern and CNC works in Cedar Falls, Iowa, said his business was doing okay initially because it worked ahead to meet orders from Deere. If it does go longer, it could affect us, he said, told the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Casting Cleaning Inc. in Cedar Falls, which does chipping and grinding work of foundry castings for John Deere, was closed Friday because of lack of work, but company president Shannon Clausen said expected the plant to reopen Monday. Long term, the strike would be very detrimental to our business. Short term, we'll be able to power through and get through it, Clausen said. And then one more on the John Deere strike, and this is an opinion piece from the Quad City Times, and it's headlined, Deere Strike Touches Us All. A strike at Deere and Company means something in the Quad Cities. It is no accident that many here remember the last time there was a Deere strike in 1986, and that it lasted almost 6 months, 163 days to be precise. A strike at Deere doesn't just ripple through this community, it makes waves. The Quad City economy is closely tied to Deere. It includes not just the thousands of Deere workers and their families, but also untold others whose companies and livelihoods are affected because of their contractual relationships with the country. As Dave Swenson, an economist at Iowa State University, said, you are disproportionately dependent upon manufacturing and disproportionately dependent upon one company. The extent to which that is true has changed over the years, but our economic well-being is undoubtedly joined with Deere. Still, we have to say, it is more than our economy. Deere and its workers are an integral piece of the Quad Cities identity. Anybody who has worked there and who has family members who have worked there knows what it means to be part of John Deere. Even those who haven't been part of this company know its important place in our community. So, yes, a strike doesn't just ripple through our community, it makes waves. It was just Sunday that 90% of workers who are covered under a proposed six-year contract overwhelmingly rejected the deal. The contract would have covered 10,000 production and maintenance workers at 14 sites, including several plants in the Quad Cities. And at a minute before midnight, late Wednesday, workers went on strike. John Deere has more than 27,000 employees in the U.S. and Canada, and it said this week that its operations will continue. The outlines of the deal's economic terms, whether it was in terms of wages or retirement benefits, have been reported. It is not our purpose today to pass judgment on who is right or wrong in this dispute, but it's clear by the margin of the workforce rejection of the proposal that there is a wide gulf in expectations. That so many rank-and-file workers would reject a tentative deal reached by their own union was eye-opening for many of us, who have been accustomed over the years to what has appeared to be a good labor relations at the company. This strike comes at a time when John Deere is enjoying record profits. Analysts expect Deere's annual net income to reach close to $6 billion this year. Meanwhile, workers are experiencing more bargaining power than they have had in recent memory, with a labor shortage and supply chain issues across the United States providing them a greater opportunity to push for a bigger share of the pie. Depending on the length of the strike, we expect to hear frequently the arguments of the respective parties in this dispute. Already, the company has made it known that it has a well-paid workforce. Union members, meanwhile, have stressed the company's profitability, as well as the concessions workers have made over the years. As this plays out, we expect each side to pursue its own best interests, but we, as a community, have a stake in Deere and its union workers finding common ground. Our economy and our well-being have been tested over the past year and a half, and we expect our challenges are not through. It is our hope that the difference between the two sides are resolved quickly. John Deere is a unique part of the Quad Cities. A strike affects the company and its workers the most, but is felt by all of us. And again, this was from the Quad City Times. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, October 19th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. So our first one is Randy L. Fairbanks, 54, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, October 16th. A celebration of Randy's life will be held at 6 p.m. on Wednesday at Waterbury Funeral Service at Sioux City at 4125 Orleans Avenue. Visitation with the family will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday. Randy Lee Fairbanks was born on February 18, 1967 in Sioux City, the son of Elroy and Jerry Thompson Fairbanks. He graduated from North High School in 1985. Randy worked almost 30 years at Interbank Foods in North Sioux City. Randy is survived by his son John, daughter Andrea Vitos, and Kaylin Fairbanks, mother Jerry Fairbanks, brothers Chad, Joey, Corey, and Carrie, and sisters Jennifer, Dana, Amanda, and Shayla. He was preceded in death by his father Elroy. Barbara Nonneman, Melvin, Iowa, 87, died Friday, October 15th. Services will be October 19th at 10:30 a.m. at the American Lutheran Church in Melbourne. Burial will be at the Baker Township Cemetery in Melbourne. Visitation was held October 18th from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Sanborn Funeral Home in Sanborn. Leon James Holzman, Lamars, 83, died Thursday, October 14th. Services will be October 22nd at 10:30 a.m. at the All Saints Catholic Parish in All Saints Catholic Parish St. Joseph Church in Lamars. Burial will be following the service at the Calvary Cemetery in Lamars. Visitation will be October 21st from 2 to 7 p.m. at the church and resume 1 hour prior to service time. Arrangements with the Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. We now have a South Dakota story. The headline is Two Summoned in Noam Inquiry. South Dakota lawmakers examining the July 2020 meeting. South Dakota lawmakers have summoned two people who were present at a meeting Governor Kristi Noem held last year that included her daughter Cassidy Peters and state employees who were overseeing Peters' application for a real estate appraiser license. The legislature's Government Operations and Audit Committee, which is controlled by Republicans, sent letters asking Secretary of Labor and Regulation Marsha Holtman and former director of the state's appraiser certification program Sherry Brenn to show up at a meeting next week. Although it isn't clear what will be asked of the women, the requests for them to appear at the meeting show that lawmakers want more answers from the Republican governor. Brenn and Holtman were central to the episode that has raised concerns from ethic experts. They attended the meeting in the governor's office in July 2020, just days after Brenn's agency moved to deny Peters a certification to become a residential appraiser. Peters received her license 4 months after the meeting. And days after she received it, Holtman allegedly pressured Brenn to retire. Brenn eventually left her job this year after the state paid her $200,000 to withdraw an age discrimination complaint. Noam has dismissed concerns about the episode by saying she never requested special treatment for her daughter and casting her actions as an effort to cut the red tape to address a shortage of appraisers certified by the state. She also has said the initial report on the meeting from the Associated Press was a political hack. Republican lawmakers on the committee said they would start with questions about why there was a shortage of appraisers under Brenn's leadership. Secretary Holtman is prepared to talk about how South Dakota has made positive changes to their appraiser certification program, said Dawn Dover, a spokeswoman for the Department of Labor and Regulation. However, Republicans acknowledge that the committee could also hone in on whether Noam inappropriately interfered in the agency while her daughter was applying for a license. Anything is fair game, especially when there is public testimony, said State Representative Randy Gross, the committee's vice chair. There is no script for the meeting. Democratic State Representative Linda Duba said she wanted to focus on why the governor involved her daughter in the meeting. She planned to press for the committee to spend more time delving into the issue. I don't know what is going to come off of this, but we can't just give it 1 hour on the agenda and then walk away, she said. Both Brynn and Noam's administration have limited their comments about why she was pressured to retire, in part because the settlement agreement bars them from disparaging each other. Noam, 49, has generated speculation that she might run for president in 2024 because she formed a federal political action committee, has been assisting campaigns across the country, and has attended many of the same events as other potential GOP hopefuls. The audit committee has scheduled the matter of the July 2020 meeting as its first item on business on Thursday next week. It also requested the presence of the president of the state's appraiser association, who has been critical of Noam's handling of the agency and called for a thorough investigation. In addition, lawmakers want to hear from the Office of Risk Management, which negotiated the settlement with Brynn. And now a Nebraska story. Nebraska launches $10 million ad campaign. Nebraska is launching a new $10 million ad campaign using federal coronavirus relief money to try to lure people from other states and fill jobs amid a severe worker shortage, Governor Pete Ricketts announced on Monday. Ricketts unveiled a 104-second ad that will be chopped into segments and aired in major media markets within 500 miles of Nebraska, including Minneapolis, Kansas City, Denver, and Chicago, as well as in Austin, Texas, and Silicon Valley. The ad features numerous clips of people working in high-tech jobs, enjoying the outdoors, and buying $225,000 houses. Actor Adam Devine, a Omaha native, riffs on the state's slogan, Nebraska, the Good Life, by talking about all the good things the state offers. Ricketts defended the use of federal pandemic relief money to pay for the spot, arguing that the funding was intended to help state economies and noting that other states have used their share for similar ad campaigns. South Dakota announced last year that it was spending $5 million on federal money on a tourism ad campaign featuring Republican Governor Kristi Noem and drawing criticism that she was using the 30-second spot to raise her political profile. Ricketts does not appear in the Nebraska ad. Nebraska is one big small town, and we just have a tremendous quality of life that goes along with that, and we want people to know about that, he said at the news conference. Nebraska has been struggling for years to attract skilled workers to fill jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and other major industries. The state now has a 2.2% unemployment rate, the lowest both nationally and in state history, and has more job openings than people who are unemployed. In recent weeks, Ricketts has highlighted some of the state's efforts to help more people get jobs. Anthony Croines, the director of Nebraska's Department of Economic Development, said the ad seeks to highlight all of the available jobs and amenities in the state. He said the $225,000 home prices were shown to appeal to residents of larger cities where housing is much more expensive. Frankly, this story has been undertold and undersold, he said. We've had a great deal of humility, and we haven't shared it, and I think we can do both. Clint Rung, founder and CEO of Arch Rival, a marketing firm that handled the project, said the ad was shot in more than 60 locations and featured 170 Nebraska residents. We'll now move to the sports section, and our first story is about volleyball. And the headline is, Sergeant Bluff-Luton opens Class 3A volleyball playoffs with sweep over Harlan. The Sergeant Bluff-Luton High School volleyball team knew it had to ramp up the intensity on Monday, and the Warriors did so in the first set in a Class 3A regional quarterfinal against Harlan. The Warriors won the first set against the Cyclones 25-9, and then the Warriors went on to win the final two sets 25-14 and 25-13. To make it one step closer to the state tournament later this month in Cedar Rapids. SBL has made it to the state tournament 7 times, including a state championship in 2019, and the Warriors know in order to get there, they have to raise the level of play. They didn't look at Harlan's record, now 13-23 after Monday's loss. All the Warriors looked at their postseason record, 0-0. They've got seniors and we've got seniors, so you just have to go out and play, Warriors coach Renee Winkle said. It gives them a different push, a different mentality. It makes the atmosphere a little bit more electric. The Warriors started out the match with an 8-3 lead and led by as much as 15-6. They went on a 6-0 run, including an Alexa Trover ace. Peyton Hardy had a pair of kills, while Adie Moser also recorded a kill in that stretch. That 15-6 lead set the tone early, and the smiles and celebrations kept going throughout the night. The first set ended with a 4-0 run, starting off with an Isabel Lenz kill. Then in the second set, the Warriors started set number two with a 5-0 start. Moser started the set off with two straight kills. Maddie Hinkle followed that up with a solo block, then Moser came back with a kill to make it 4-0. Senior Emma Salker, who led the Warriors with 10 kills, posted a kill to put her team up 5-0. By the time Harlan called its second timeout, the Warriors led 20-10. It was a good team win, and it gave us a lot of confidence to begin the postseason, Salker said. Tonight was a good win for us. Everyone is going to give you their best, and you just have to be ready for everything. In the third set, the Warriors led by as many as 16-5. They wanted to come out and make a statement, and I think they came out and did that, Winkle said. Lenz had 7 kills, while Trover and Hardy had 6. Hinkle had 36 assists. Salker and Olivia Wolf had 7 digs. Now we have more volleyball stories from other towns. Akron Westfield High School volleyball team swept Siouxland Christian in Class 1A postseason play on Monday. The Westerners swept the Eagles by set scores of 25-20, 25-16, 25-14. Natalie Nielsen led the Westerners with 19 kills, while Lauren Sathoff with 13. Josie Jacobs had 43 assists in her first career postseason match. Aubie Hartman had 24 digs, while Chloe Colt had 18. And then MMCRU 3, George Little Rock 0. The Royals swept the Mustangs 25-14, 25-16, 25-18. Wiley Steenhoven had 9 kills to lead the Mustangs. Jesse DeGroote had 19 assists, while Emerson Netton had 13 digs. MMCRU faces South O'Brien in the second round on Wednesday. Remsen St. Mary's 3, River Valley 0. The Hawks had to battle in the final set to earn the sweep over the Wolverines. The Hawks swept the Wolverines 25-23, 25-15, and 26-24. Whitney Jensen had 10 kills, while Claire Schroeder had 7. Carmody Rickey had 6. Maya Bunkers posted 17 assists. The Hawks had just 9 digs, and 3 different Hawks had 2 apiece. Remsen St. Mary's faces Akron Westfield in the regional quarterfinals on Wednesday. Kingsley Pearson 3, Woodbury Central 0. The Panthers swept the Wildcats 25-17, 25-12, 25-21. Chloe Peschel led KP with 11 kills, while Mackenzie Goodwin had 8. Georgia Howe had 14 assists, and Reagan Vos had 9. Allison Rankin and Peschel had 28 assists apiece. The Wildcats were led in kills by Olivia Hassel with 8, while Mighty Schultz had 5. Kenzie Joy had 9 assists. Unity Christian 3, Pocahontas Area 0. The Knights opened up the postseason play by set scores of 25-11, 25-6, 25-7. The Knights hit 459 on the night, and Tyra Schutman had 11 kills. Grace Schoenhoven and Jaden Hoffmeyer both had 6 kills. Emma Biker had 31 assists. The Knights will play Greene County on Wednesday night. Greene County beat OABCIG in 4 sets. And that was it for local sports stories. Our next story is Iowa Guards Get Vaccine Order. About 9,000 members of the Iowa National Guard have been directed to get a COVID-19 vaccination or risk disciplinary actions that could include separation as a last resort if they refuse without citing an approved medical or religious waiver. The Department of Defense has directed the COVID-19 vaccines are now a part of our normal medical readiness requirements. As a result, we have recently initiated mandatory COVID-19 vaccination for Iowa soldiers and airmen using the FDA-approved Pfizer-BioNTech Comirnaty vaccine, Iowa National Guard spokesman Kevin Waldron said Monday. This is a readiness, health, and welfare priority for the entire United States military. The vaccination deadline for Iowa Air National Guard members is December 2nd, while the members of the Iowa Army National Guard will have until July 30th, 2022 to comply. About 65% of Iowa's roughly 9,000 Guard members had received at least their first COVID-19 vaccination as of October 15, according to Guard estimates. This past weekend, a number of additional airmen and soldiers received COVID-19 vaccinations that are not yet included in our total percentage. We will continue to see an increase in the number of members fully vaccinated. Well, any soldier who refuses the vaccine without a medical or religious exemption could face options that include reprimand up to being separated from the Iowa National Guard. Walden downplayed that possibility, saying the organization ultimately wants all of our server members to continue to serve. "We value our service members and what they bring to the table," he said. "We have trained these airmen and these soldiers for months and for years, and we value them in our organization." Though separation is an option, ultimately the Iowa National Guard wants all of our service members to continue to serve. The outcomes could vary depending on the service member, whether they follow and look for a medical or religious exemption, he said. The outcomes of that, either approved or denied, could determine the follow-on steps from there. If someone continues to refuse or is not willing to proceed with a vaccination, then there are a number of administrative things that we could do, and that could be dependent at the time. We will look at different options on an individual basis to determine what is the best for them and what is best for the organization. During a recent iHeartRadio interview, Governor Kim Reynolds indicated that while I may have the power to alter that requirement as Iowa's commander-in-chief, the Republican governor said she was concerned the Biden administration would pull Federal Defense Department funding from Guard operations if the Iowa National Guard did not comply with the mandate. "So right now we have some time," Reynolds told the talk radio host Simon Conway. "I would encourage them to file for an exemption, to get that on record and stay tuned because we continue to work on. It's beyond belief what they're doing. They're taking away the freedom of choice, and so we're going to work with that. But that is what they always come back to. It's the threat of federal funding that will be pulled if we don't line up with what their requirements are," she said. "That's some of the things that we're continuing to look at as we work through this. It's a moving target with this Biden administration." Earlier this year, Pentagon officials said they would seek to add the COVID-19 vaccine to the list of other inoculations that service members are already required to get. They noted the Delta variant is highly contagious and that service members live and work closely together in barracks, increasing the risks of an outbreak that could impact crisis readiness. "The organization needs to maintain its readiness and our capabilities to deploy here within Iowa or worldwide. The Iowa National Guard needs to maintain the people who are capable of fulfilling the mission that needs to be done," Waldron said. "Just like any private business or public organization, there are policies and procedures in place, and the Iowa National Guard is following the Department of Defense policies and procedures. We are moving forward with this COVID-19 vaccination implementation." We now have a story about an event that was this past weekend, and the headline is "Creative Couture and Rock Come Together for a Sound and Style Fashion Show." Decked out in a leopard-spotted top, alligator green sleeves and coral pants, Tolliver Shern knows a thing or two when it comes to working it on a fashion runway. "You're always thinking about your next move," he says with a smile. "You also spend a lot of time looking at yourself in the bedroom, perfecting the perfect pose." That's because Shern isn't a professional Zoolander. Instead, he is a Western Iowa Tech Community College student who will be modeling creative couture at the Sound and Style Fashion Show Saturday at the Warrior Hotel at 525 6th Street. So this was this past Saturday. This was a fundraiser for the Sioux City Conservatory of Music, and it began with a pre-symphony matinee from 4 to 6 p.m., and then a second set fashion show, which was emceed by the Weekender's Earl Horlick, took place from 7 to 9 p.m., and ended with a DJ dance party starting at 9 p.m. So, what does fashion have to do with music? According to the Conservatory of Music co-founder Gia Emery, there's always been a connection between musicians and designers. "When you think of David Bowie or Prince, their look is as important as their sound," she explains. For many years, Emery was a West Coast stylist for such fashionable females as Britney Spears and Priscilla Presley. Grace Emery is just as stylish as her mom. Indeed, the North High School 11th grader is considering a career as a fashion designer. "You don't have to spend a lot of money to look good," she says. "You can take old clothing, make a few alterations, and turn it into something really eye-catching." Displaying an example of her upcycle style, Grace Emery was wearing an old cardigan sweater, a vintage concert t-shirt, wraparound skirt, and leggings. East High School 10th grader Chloe Roop was boasting a similar look with a cardigan, animal print leggings, and flowery dress. My style is a bit retro and a bit futuristic at the same time, Roop, who cites both singer Lady Gaga and designer Betsy Johnson as style icons. Like Grace Emery, Roop is an aspiring fashion designer who will be showing off fashion during this Sound and Style show. My grandmother taught me how to sew, Roop says. I've been experimenting with fabrics ever since. In addition to Roop and Grace Emery, clothing designed by Rachel Ann Rainwater of Los Angeles and Sean Bolte of Minneapolis will also be shown on the runway. So will Paul Shelstead, a Sioux City-based artist who will be exhibiting some of his graffiti-inspired fashions. Certain to be snapping plenty of high-fashion photos will be Miguel Almarez Castanino, the 21-year-old owner of a graphic design collective, Nasty Collective. I take photos, shoot video, create graphic design, and even do a bit of podcasting whenever I get a chance, he says. Gotta do whatever you can to get by. For much of the past 5 years, Almarez Castaneda was homeless. My mom turned me away when I was 16, he says, but I'm my own ever since. That hasn't stifled his ambitions or his creativity. He cites his Biggie Smalls, Tupac Shakur, and Quentin Tarantino as unlikely muses. Their style in hip-hop as well as in filmmaking, he says. I like that. So, who is Rebecca Erickson's fashion hero? Probably not her dad. I've seen Becca buy old men's jeans from the Goodwill, change a few things, and wear them to school, Tim Erickson says as his Sergeant Bluff Luton Community High School daughter walks down the Sound and Style runway. I'll tell her that I have plenty of old jeans that she can upcycle. So far, Becca hasn't taken me up on my offer. Fashion is a creative outlet, Rebecca Erickson says. I just like taking something used and making it new again, the first-time model says. While Rebecca Erickson is still working the kinks out of her model poses, Zoe Belke already feels at home in front of a crowd. I've never modeled before, but I'm a singer, so the Western Iowa Tech Community College student turned model for a night says. A runway is just a different type of stage. Which is a good attitude to have. After all, fashion inspires confidence. I started getting into fashion as a way to express myself creatively, Grace Emery says. I show the world who I am when I dress the way I do. Chloe Whoopi nods her head in agreement. Fashion should show off your personality, she says. It is a reflection of who you are. Wearing some fashionably destroyed jeans, cool kicks, and a white dress shirt, photographer Almarez Castaneda is just as trendy as anybody on the runway. Being confident in yourself is key, he says. That's true, no matter what you do. Now we move to Dear Abby. Our letter. Dear Abby, 35 years ago, I was raped by a stranger. He told me he would kill me if I ever told anyone. I never told my husband, now ex-husband, mostly because I was afraid if I did, he would never touch me again. So I lived with the secret, eventually tore our marriage apart, and we divorced. Although we have both moved on and remarried, we have remained in touch. I am 60 now, and he is 64. I yearn to tell him the story before one of us leaves this earth. I want him to understand and hopefully forgive me for the events that drove us apart. The need to tell him is so strong, I cry about it. Please advise me on this. Signed, still not over it in Maryland. And Abby responds, if it will bring you comfort, reveal the secret you hid from your ex-husband. However, before you do, I urge you to first disclose it to someone trained to help victims of rape. If there's a rape treatment center near you, please make an appointment. If there isn't one, a referral from your doctor to a licensed mental health professional would also be beneficial. Trust me on that. Dear Abby, we invited friends over to enjoy our bounty from a successful fishing trip. They live about an hour away. They accepted our invitation, then followed up with, can you put us and our two dogs up overnight if we drink too much? I replied that we meant the invitation for humans only this time. They replied, we're sorry you don't want our well-behaved girls in your newly remodeled home. And Abby, they didn't come. Was I wrong? Should I have handled this better? I'm kind of feeling that they were wrong. Signed, animal lover, but... And Abby replies, I'm also kind of feeling they overreacted. If you preferred they not bring uninvited guests, whether the two-footed or four-footed variety, you were within your rights to refuse to have them. Please stop guessing yourself. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, October 19th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.